From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, multiple casualties are reported after a UN shelter is hit by Israeli shelling in northern Gaza. We hear from a reporter in the region.
Very disturbing to see an apparent shelling on a location that's supposed to be a refuge for people who have nowhere else to go.
Also today, the EU gets ready to slap tougher sanctions on Russia over its perceived support for pro-separatist rebels. And for a third time this year, a US execution fails to go to plan, taking nearly 2 hours for a convicted murderer to die.
When these individuals die, they are essentially dying of a narcotic overdose. So this inmate death sounds like what you see when someone has a heroin overdose, which is pretty ugly.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. It's been another deadly few hours in Gaza, where Palestinian officials say at least 15 people were killed after a UN-run school being used as a shelter was shelled by Israeli forces. Hundreds of Palestinians were in the building at the time. Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond has joined the effort to persuade Israel and Hamas to agree to a truce. Speaking in Israel, he told reporters he's still hopeful an agreement can be struck.
Discussions are ongoing, and I hope very much that a ceasefire deal is imminent and that that ceasefire in turn can lead to something more permanent that addresses the underlying causes of this conflict.
Attempts are underway to locate the wreckage of an Algerian airliner that is believed to have crashed on a flight from Burkina Faso to Algiers. The plane with 116 people aboard, 50 of them French, lost contact with air traffic controllers as it flew above the Sahara and crossed into Mali. The last contact with the jet came 50 minutes after takeoff. Chris Parrott, the managing director of aviation security company Avsec Global, says the jet went down in an area with very little radar.
In Europe, we're very used to all of our airspace, or most of our airspace, being covered by radar. It's very easy to track aircraft. However, in North Africa, that's not the case, and pilots rely on what they call procedural navigation, where they make radio calls at various waypoints.
The Australian government has sent 50 police officers to London ahead of a potential mission to eastern Ukraine to secure the Malaysian Airlines crash site. Reporters at the scene say access to the site remains a total free-for-all, with no meaningful exclusion zone in place around the wreckage. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says his government's operation to bring the 28 Australian passengers home is now in full swing.
There has still not been anything like a thorough professional search of the area where the plane came down. And there can't be, while the site is controlled by armed men with a vested interest in the outcome of any investigation.
Lawyers for a double murderer who took nearly 2 hours to be executed in Arizona on Wednesday night are demanding an external review of the process. Joseph Wood gasped and snorted for an hour and 40 minutes after a lethal cocktail of drugs was administered. Among the witnesses, reporter Michael Kiefer of the Arizona Republic.
This is the fifth execution I've witnessed. I've seen them done with thiopental, with pentobarbital. Usually takes about 10 minutes. The person goes to sleep. This was not that.
Arizona's Republican governor, Jan Brewer, has ordered an investigation, but is already claiming publicly that the inmate did not suffer during the execution. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A Sudanese woman who was sentenced to death after being accused of renouncing Islam has met the Pope on her first day of freedom in Italy. Maryam Yahia Ibrahim Ishak flew to Rome after spending more than a month sheltering at the US Embassy in the Sudanese capital Khartoum. FSN's Jack Parrock reports from our Europe desk in Brussels.
Maryam Yahia Ibrahim Ishak and her two young children have arrived in Italy after flying on a government plane accompanied by Italian Minister Lapo Pistelli. Mrs. Ibrahim's case caused outrage when she was sentenced to hang for apostasy, renouncing her faith, in Sudan. However, Maryam, who is married to a Christian from South Sudan who has US nationality, insists she'd never been a Muslim, as she was raised by her Christian mother. In Sudan's version of Islamic law, the fact that her father was a Muslim means she is too. Following international outrage at the sentence, a Sudanese appeals court quashed it. Mrs. Ibrahim has flown to Italy with her two young children, including her baby daughter, daughter who was born while she was in jail.
New sanctions are expected to be unveiled by the European Union against Russia soon for its alleged role in the crash of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, but Russia continues to deny responsibility for the disaster, and many officials in Moscow are dismissing the economic impact of Western sanctions, as FSN's Jack Rashbass reports from the Russian capital.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that attempts to pressure Russia with sanctions are absolutely unacceptable and counterproductive. One Russian minister has gone so far as to describe the effect of Western sanctions as peanuts, and Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev insists that the EU will remain Russia's major trade partner for a long time. Meanwhile, Russia's former finance minister has warned that isolationist sentiments were damaging the country's economic and political modernization. This comes as Moscow's MICEX index has fallen to the lowest levels in 4 months since the latest round of sanctions.
And that is the latest Feature Story News. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Multiple casualties are being reported after a United Nations shelter was hit by Israeli shelling in northern Gaza. UN officials say no warning was given by Israel before the missile struck. The Israeli Defense Forces are blaming Hamas for the incident. The Gazan Ministry of Health says at least 10 people are dead and many more wounded. The UN school had been converted to house Palestinian families who'd been displaced by the Israeli offensive. Kristen Chick is in Gaza for the Christian Science Monitor.
Witnesses who are at the shelter this afternoon described multiple explosions that ripped through the courtyard where people were gathered to move to a safer place. They said that the school, the shelter, was hit by shelling from Israeli tanks that are definitely within range of the school. The IDF has suggested that the explosion may have been a Hamas rocket that misfired and hit the school, but that doesn't really jive with witness descriptions of multiple explosions that sounded like tank shelling. And I do have to say that Gaza residents are by now fairly expert at identifying different types of artillery and airstrikes.
And what do we have in terms of the latest on fatalities and, of course, those injured?
It appears that at least 15 have died and more than 200 people are injured. And I unfortunately expect that death toll may go up as some of the injured die.
And there have been some reports that this building, this school, has been targeted in the past. Do you know anything about that?
Well, it appears to have been hit by a strike a few days ago, although I'm not sure if it was the same place. But I do know that that several shelters have been hit directly by Israeli fire in the past few days.
There was also a suggestion that Israel was given a report on the coordinates of this particular shelter. Have you heard anything on that?
Yes, the spokesman for the UN agency that runs the shelter said that he had given Israel the precise location of the shelter, the exact coordinates. And he also said that he tried to coordinate a window today to evacuate people from the shelter and take them elsewhere as fighting grew closer to that shelter, and he said Israel refused.
And with that growing Palestinian death toll in Gaza, Israel has repeated that it insists people must leave their homes and take shelter from those airstrikes and that ground operation. But if they can't go to a UN shelter, where can they go?
That is exactly right. This is exactly the kind of place that is supposed to be safe from shelling. These are the places that people are supposed to go to leave the Israeli assaults that may or may not hit their houses. And so it's, very disturbing to see an apparent airstrike or shelling, rather, on a location that's supposed to be a refuge for people who have nowhere else to go.
Kristen Chick in Gaza for the Christian Science Monitor. Now, staying with Gaza, and the United Nations humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, today described a ceasefire as vital, as Gaza residents continue to be displaced with food and water in short supply. FSN's Nick Harper is at the UN in New York and began by telling me exactly what that appeal involved.
The UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, has spoken up about the situation. She's particularly worried about the impact on civilians, the humanitarian situation. And she says, quite simply, the fighting must end.
Some kind of ceasefire and stop to the violence is absolutely vital. In the meantime, we are extremely concerned with a deteriorating humanitarian situation. People are running out of food. Water is also a serious concern. The situation is even more dire.
Amos is also saying that 44% of Gaza is now a no-go area because of the fighting. And as well as running out of food and water, civilians are simply not having any options of places they can shelter.
And Nick, we've also heard from Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and it seems that he's been particularly critical of the UN.
Yes, some very strong comments from Israel's Prime Minister. Benjamin Netanyahu is particularly unhappy about the UN Human Rights Council's decision to launch an inquiry into alleged human rights violations carried out by Israel. We had comments from the UN Human Rights Chief Nave Pillay on Wednesday saying that potentially the actions of Israel could constitute war crimes. And it's those two things that Netanyahu is criticising.
It's a travesty of justice. It's a travesty of fairness. It's a travesty of common sense. It's a travesty of truth. And I think that it will not prevent us from continuing to act to defend our people.
Netanyahu says that Israel won't back down. Hamas says they won't agree to a ceasefire until the blockade is lifted by Israel. So at this stage, despite the fact that more than 750 people have died, mainly Palestinians, in just over 2 weeks, the conflict looks set to continue.
Nick Harper at the UN headquarters. The death toll in Gaza has now reached over 700, with 30 Israelis killed in the fighting. Intense mediation efforts continue to try to broker a truce between Hamas and Israel, but so far without agreement. Around 120,000 Palestinians have been forced to leave their homes. Carl Shembi of the charity Save the Children told LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz that the situation for Gaza's children is desperate.
Well, it's a terrible situation for children to be in, for anyone really, but one of the most vulnerable sectors of society is now under attack. This is a war on children. One child every hour is being killed in the war on Gaza. The shocking number of children and injured demands an unequivocal international response to stop the bloodshed. The people are fleeing to wherever they can, schools, hospitals, which are also coming under attack. There's nowhere safe, nowhere to flee. Children are seeing their families, relatives, dying in front of them. Our initial estimates are that right now, more than 116,000 children need specialized psychological support for what they've been through, and the numbers keep increasing.
There are reports, Carl, that the leader of Hamas suggested that Hamas would agree to a temporary humanitarian ceasefire. Are you able to update us on that? How would that help?
Well, from the experience in this escalation and previous ones, those are very small, fragile reprieves, small windows of opportunity, which are very fragile, which can break down at any point. Of course, any truce is welcome at this point because the families are just destroyed, battered. They need to stock up, replenish. We need to save the children to go out and also reach the most vulnerable people. Our staff are risking their lives together with many other agencies trying to save lives, deliver life-saving aid. But it is what we need is beyond the ceasefire. There needs to be an agreement, a long-term agreement that will target the root causes of this problem, including an end to the blockade. The 1.8 million people of Gaza, half of them children, have been living under lock and key for the last 7 years now. They cannot go out, they cannot go abroad, they cannot even visit the other side of their country.
Carl Shembi of the charity Save the Children. This is FSN Reports. The governor of Arizona is calling for a full inquiry after it took an inmate almost 2 hours to die by lethal injection. Eyewitness accounts say convicted double murderer Joseph Wood gasped and struggled to breathe before dying in the early hours of Thursday. Arizona officials present said Mr. Wood was comatose and didn't suffer. This is the third bungled execution in the US this year. Death penalty expert and general surgeon in Columbus, Ohio, Dr. Jonathan Groner, says the cocktail of drugs used can't guarantee an effective execution.
I'm not surprised that the drugs that are being used for these executions do not have the properties that are likely to result in a successful execution.
Why is that? Why don't they?
Well, I think the drugs that were used for yesterday's execution are relatively similar to the drugs that I get when I have a colonoscopy. They're not anesthetic drugs. And the old three-drug combination used a thiopental, which is an anesthetic, used a muscle-blocking agent, Avulon, Tancuronium, and then used the potassium chloride. So the three-drug regimen, in that case, the drugs were actually used for general anesthesia, stopping the breathing, and then stopping the heart. The current drugs that are being used are a drug that's designed to reduce procedural anxiety, the midazolam, and the other one is a synthetic narcotic, which is a pain reliever, but is not really an anesthetic. And I think the result of that is that when these individuals die, they are essentially dying of a narcotic overdose. So this inmate's death sounds like what you see when someone has a heroin overdose, which is pretty ugly.
Arizona state officials who were attending that execution last night, they say that he was the inmate was comatose and didn't suffer. What's your medical opinion on that hypothesis?
My medical opinion is it's really difficult to know without any assessment of the inmates. I mean, again, when someone is under general anesthesia for an operation, we have an anesthesiologist who assesses the depth of anesthesia. This involves things like measuring heart rate and blood pressure and a response to painful stimuli, and in some cases, even brainwave monitoring. You know, there's nobody with that qualification in that room, so there is nobody who can assess that or not. And so I think it's an assumption that the inmate's not suffering, although someone who is, gassing like a fish out of water for 2 hours, I think most people would perceive that to be suffering. And certainly a number of witnesses who watched the execution felt very disturbed by it. So I think the absence of proof does not mean that it was absent. He may have been suffering. We don't really know. But this is a medical procedure that is being performed by people who don't have medical qualifications typically, and we don't know who put in the IV. We don't know how they got the drugs. We don't know how they mixed the drugs. So there's numerous failure points in this procedure, and that's why I'm not surprised that it went so poorly.
So what is the solution? Because I know some states put forward the idea of reintroducing the electric chair, but then we're back to the same problem that we have here, which is that this is unconstitutional, perhaps, because it's considered cruel or unusual punishment and therefore violates that Eighth Amendment right of the inmate.
Right. The electric chair has set a number of people on fire, which I think is easily violates the Eighth Amendment rights. I think your choices are to get rid of capital punishment altogether, like the entire European Union, or, a lot of people have brought up the issue of firing squad. You know, it turns out that the prison guards who do the lethal injections, which is way out of their scope of practice, are actually trained to fire guns, and I think if you do a side-by-side comparison between firing squad and lethal injection, you know, there's not a lot of failed firing squad executions, and they don't take 2 hours, so you know, it's very ugly, and it's very unpleasant to watch, and it's, but I think that the problem with lethal injection is that it creates this sort of veneer of medical respectability for what's actually, you know, a state-sponsored homicide. You know, firing squad takes away that veneer and really puts the question to the public, you know, do we as a country really want to keep doing this or not.
When you're pulled into this debate, Dr. Groner, and someone turns to you and says, well, hang on a minute, what about the opinion that the method of execution is almost irrelevant because in this instance, as an example, the man was a double murderer, convicted double murderer?
Well, I think the point is that, you know, from a constitutional standpoint, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, the worst penalty that can be meted out in this country is death, is that someone has committed crimes that are so severe that they can be deprived, that person can be deprived of his life. And it's the same punishment whether you kill one person, two people, or 100 people, it's still to be deprived of your life. And it specifically says in our Constitution, you can be deprived of your life, but we can't torture you in the process. And I think, you know, the founders of our country were conscious of what went on in, you know, medieval Europe, where people were routinely tortured, and that, you know, the manner of execution had to do with someone's status in society. So a person of high-ranking status could have their head taken off with a sword with a nice clean cut, and a person, you know, lower ranking society, you know, got hacked to death or something like that. So that, you know, our Constitution, the people who founded our country were very sensitive to this idea that the worst penalty you can get is death, and it's not torture and death, it's just death. And I think that's a tough concept for people, and certainly understand, you know, victims' families obviously have a strong desire for the inmate to suffer as their loved ones suffer, and that sort of retribution was purposely not included when our country was founded and its criminal justice system was designed as it's written in the Constitution.
Death penalty expert Dr. Jonathan Groner. Now, 1 week on from the crash of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, and the people of the Netherlands have been coming to terms with one of the biggest tragedies to ever hit the nation. The majority of those who perished in last week's air disaster were Dutch nationals. As bodies continue to arrive from Ukraine, our correspondent Sandra Gatman has been speaking to residents in Amsterdam and says that for many, grief over the incident has turned to anger.
At one of central Amsterdam's oldest bakeries, work continues as normal. But this employee says the MH17 plane crash is still all anyone can talk about.
It's very, very, very sad. Everybody talks about it and we have to move on, but it's now, yeah, it's so fresh.
With bodies from passengers and crew killed on board MH17 being slowly returned to the Netherlands, some of that grief has been relieved. But much of the shock and sadness here has evolved into anger.
On Facebook you see the Russian people, blah, 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 and yeah, that's we feel the angry.
3 days after the tragedy, the normally cool-headed Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, got tough with Russia.
It is absolutely necessary and the first priority that the repatriation of the victims takes place as quickly as possible. Anyone who does not fully cooperate leaves a mark of suspicion on himself.
Many Dutch people have welcomed their government's strong show of leadership.
Being what we are, a small, not too important country, I think they've handled it quite well. Because on the one hand, saying it's awful and we are very unhappy with it, first, make your target clear, which is getting the body out.
Especially after outrage over images from East Ukraine showing pro-Russian militants mishandling victims' bodies and belongings.
The way in how the bodies are coming back to the Netherlands is making the Dutch people very angry. Why is it so difficult to give it back?
With the Dutch government leading an international investigation into the crash, this tragedy will remain a focal point for the nation. Sandra Gatman, Amsterdam.
And it's the circumstances surrounding the downing of Flight 17 that has European Union officials chewing over what punishment to hand down to Russia over its widely perceived support for pro-separatist rebels in Ukraine. Over 200 EU citizens were among those killed when the plane was brought down. A decision on tougher sanctions against Russia is expected to be thrashed out in Brussels over the coming days. LBC's Jim Diamond discussed what impact might be felt by Moscow with former British diplomat Charles Crawford.
Well, I think the sanctions which are being discussed, actually, it looks as if from the newspapers this morning, as if they're actually going quite a lot further than we'd all thought. It's much more than targeted sanctions against individuals. It's sort of sector-wide sanctions. It would have the effect of affecting Russian investment, Russian bonds, and so on and so on. So this is quite a big package, actually. Now, that's not to say it will go through, because precisely because it's the bigger the package, perhaps the less likely it is to go through, because everyone has to agree. But I think there are two issues here. There are whether or not sanctions really make a sort of negative difference on Russia, and of course they make some negative difference on us, but will President Putin be worried about that, as you ask? And I think the answer is yes and no. I think part of him will genuinely be unhappy that things are going in this direction, but I think part of his psychology also is that he is defiant in the face of, you know, what he will present as the European Union punishing Russia for having done nothing in his eyes.
And how would he react to any sanctions imposed?
Well, that's a good question. And I think the basic philosophy of Russian foreign policy, Soviet foreign policy going back, is anything you do to us, we will do worse to you. So I think we'll have to see whether or not he can come up with a way of actually making life more difficult for us. One way he may make life more difficult for us is to make life a lot more difficult for Ukraine. Because he may say, of course, that this is the risk of all these situations, that actually, if he's got less to lose, then he might as well grab what he can and hope for the best. So maybe more weapons will go into Ukraine. Maybe, you know, other actions will take place to destabilize the country. The basic problem I think he has in Ukraine is that the Ukrainian people are not rising up to support him, perhaps the way he thought they would at the beginning of the whole crisis. So I think his options actually are slightly diminishing. But that's not to say that he will take all this lightly.
Do you think it's embarrassing at all for the UK government when the American intelligence agencies were suggesting there was no direct link between the plane coming down and the Russian government?
Well, not really, actually, because I think it's one thing. I think really what they're saying is they haven't found a direct link, because I think it's still going to take a while to pour through thousands of conversations and so on to check exactly what it is was going on down there on the ground in eastern Ukraine. So I think there's also what the question of a direct link is. There's no doubt whatsoever that everything going on down in that part of Ukraine is massively influenced by Russia. And perhaps the worst thing is that Russia, after the crash, didn't use whatever influence it had to get the victims be dealt with decently and so on. So this is a very serious mess, I think. And I don't think Russia emerges from this with any credit, but in all these situations you've got to prove exactly what happened, and this may in fact take years, because there will be investigations and hearings and evidence produced, and gradually it'll disappear into the long grass.
And finally, should any sanctions go ahead, clearly if the atmosphere turns even more frosty, will that become more awkward and difficult for David Cameron when he does next meet Mr. Putin?
Well, that's the point. I mean, you that's the point of sanctions. You're meant to express that you are angry with the other side. And that's, of course, it will be very difficult, but it's going to be difficult for all European leaders. Mr. Putin, I think the big point for listeners to understand with this one is that Russia suddenly has found itself with very few friends around the world. It's one thing defying the West on Zimbabwe or Syria or something. It's another thing seemingly having fingerprints on a crash of a civilian airliner where every country in the world knows that its people could have been on that plane. And the way the whole thing has been handled, as it were, during the crash and after the crash has been very damaging. So I think Russia's popularity, Russia's credibility has taken a big hit, and that's going to mean that Russia's meetings with lots of leaders, apart from maybe places like Serbia, where they stick with Russia come what may, are going to get pretty frosty.
LBC's Jim Diamond with former British diplomat Charles Crawford. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, email us reports@featurestory.com or follow us on Twitter @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.